Hello, everybody. This is Queer Voices, a home-produced podcast that has grown out of a radio show that's been on the air in Houston, Texas for several decades. This week, Brian Levinka talks with two of Houston Pride Parade's Grand Marshal candidates, Andrew Edmondson and Melissa Vivanco. Then Brian talks with another Grand Marshal candidate, Travis Torrance.
Coming out, being able to be my true and authentic self in every single context of my life, it saved my life. And it's another reason why I give back and try to encourage inclusivity, diversity, and equity in all communities so that people will feel comfortable coming out.
And Deborah Moncrief Bell has a conversation with author and playwright Brendan Borkshiel.
Despite the fact that we are all compassionate to the people who are in our proximity, sometimes we lose that compassion with distance. And what the healthcare system does is it creates all different kinds of distance between one human being and another.
Queer Voices starts now.
This is Brian Levinka, and today we're starting interviews with the Grand Marshal nominees for the 2022 Pride Parade. Today we have Andrew Edmondson and Melissa Vivanco, the male identifying Grand Marshal nominee and the female identifying Grand Marshal nominee. Welcome, guys.
Thank you for having us.
Excited to be here.
Can you start out by telling us who you are? Let's start with Andrew. Who are you?
My name is Andrew Edmondson. I've lived in Houston since 1990, and my activism and commitment to the community was spurred by what I experienced here as a young gay man in my mid-20s arriving in Texas from London, where I had done an internship after graduating. There was an epidemic of anti-gay violence. It was quite common for gay men to be beat up on the streets of Montrose, to be murdered on the streets of Montrose. And unfortunately, we were at the peak of the AIDS crisis. Houston was being devastated by HIV and AIDS. Houston had the seventh highest number of cases in the nation for HIV/AIDS. And I was drawn to action to try to stop the violence that was resulting in the deaths of gay men. And I was also drawn to action to try to help people who were living with HIV. And for me, those have been three decade-long commitments that unfortunately are still relevant and still need attention, support, and advocacy. But I do feel like the city has changed, Texas has changed, America has changed, and things have gotten better. And not in any grandiose way due to my advocacy, but I do feel like I'm a foot soldier in the March for Equality, along with terrific people like Melissa Vivanco, who has been an incredible leader over the last decade, and that we are pushing the ball forward and creating change.
Melissa, who are you?
Well, my name is Melissa Vivanco, and best way to kind of describe, you know, my activism and what I've done in the community is kind of share a story about how my activism started. So in 2013, one of my best friends at the time took me to DC for the Human Rights Campaign, HRC National Dinner and Lobby Day. I had actually no idea what to expect. Volunteers from 32 cities from around the country meet twice a year in DC, and they really meet to push equality forward. This was the first time I actually stepped into the U.S. Capitol. I was pretty much in awe just walking through the halls. The political co-chairs at the time for the Houston HRC Steering Committee were Lorenz Snowden and Ryan Levy. That was the first time I met those two individuals, and wow, just watching them speak was pretty incredible. We went from meeting to meeting with our representatives of Texas, you know, talking at the time we were trying to push ENDA, the Employment Non-Discrimination Act. At the time, we were also trying to push Women Against Violence Act, and we were reviewing the Equality Index for each of the Texas representatives. As the day kind of went on and I watched as Lorenz and the steering committee would, you know, speak with the staffers, we were on our very last visit to the meeting with the Texas representative of Beaumont. And that was the first time that I really felt this staffer does not want to see us. This staffer could visibly see her behavior was not anything conducive to any of us getting anything said that she would listen to. And that was the moment that I kind of got angry. And when I got angry in that moment, I made the decision to speak. And when I spoke, I really wanted to capture my anger in a way that would make her understand why she needed to listen to us. And I explained to her that everybody that was sitting around the table had paid for a flight to come to DC, had paid for a hotel, and it was a Thursday. So most of us who had full-time jobs took time off of work to come here and sit in front of her. And immediately when I said that, I could notice a visible change in her behavior and her body tone. And she became more calm, listened to us, and we felt like we came out of that meeting with someone that actually listened versus just pushed us aside. And that's the real moment where I really understood the power of my voice. And from that moment forward, I decided I wanted to get involved somehow with HRC. And that's where I moved to joining the HR steering committee and eventually being the political co-chair for the human rights campaign and became a national board of governors.
Can you tell us how you came out? Let's start with you, Melissa.
I came out, I would say, publicly and with my family in 2001. I had moved from Nogales, Arizona, a border town. I'm a border town girl, bordered from Mexico and Arizona. I moved here in 2001, the year the Texans became an expansion team. And I remember hearing all about whether or not what the name of the team was going to be. So I always remember the year I got here was the year we named the Texans and got a football team again. And I walked in my first Pride Parade because one of the first people I met in Houston worked at HEB and he was gay and he wanted to walk in the Pride Parade with HEB. And that was my first Pride event ever in 2001. And I went to every Pride Parade after that. And in every capacity, I can tell you that if it wasn't me, you know, walking in the parade, the only year that I didn't walk was the year that I went to the Texas Democratic Convention to try to be a national delegate. But my vehicle still came out in the Pride Parade. And when I came out in 2001, it started with my family, right? I made the decision that it was time for my family to know that my sexual orientation at that point, I wasn't sure. I started with, I think I'm bisexual, and relayed that information to my family. My family is a Latino family. So the immediate response wasn't what, you know, we would want to hope for, right? It was a little bit of concern with love, but it was still concern. And I'll never forget my mom. She said, okay, mijita, just please let's not tell anyone else. And what I've learned through the scope of coming out is that we have to give our parents the ability to kind of go through this themselves, right? And I since that experience, and my family is very welcoming. I'm out at work. There, I went from being very closeted to being actively and socially out with the community, because I think it's important that we learn from our experiences. And I learned through the experience with my family and, you know, the way they feel sometimes that they don't want anybody else to know, to then taking them fast forward to 2016 and having them join the HRC dinner and having my parents meet Chad Griffin. And, you know, it's just been a complete different, completely different the way we started to where we are now. And I encourage, and I talk about this a lot with people that ask me, you know, how do I tell my parents, or what should I do now that my parents are telling me to not say anything? And I think it's really important that we understand that our parents also have a process they have to go through. So I can tell you that, you know, while it wasn't an easy process, it has been probably the most incredible journey with my, not only with my friends, but my family at the forefront, and they are absolutely welcoming. They love me, and now my entire family knows I am very active about, you know, being a lesbian in the community.
Andrew, how did you come out?
They say that you have to come out over and over in many different areas of your life, personally, at work, politically. The first memory that popped into my head when you asked the question was when I was 15 years old. And I was president of the drama club, and I was starring in a drama production. And one of my best friends was the female lead in the production. And we were incredibly bonded. And I had met a guy, and I was deeply infatuated with him, and he liked me back. And I thought it was wonderful that I had finally found this glorious guy, and I wanted to share that with her. And she was also, at that point in her life, deeply Christian. And I remember I told her that I was gay, and she burst out crying, and she immediately hugged me. And for me, that was a real mixed message. The crying said, oh my goodness, this is terrible news. This is really bad. The hugging me said, I still love you and care about you. So that was in 1980. That was a very conservative time. The attitudes towards homosexuality were not nearly as evolved as they are now. And that friend, who still today remains a lifelong friend, and we are very close, she's totally on board and totally supports me. But I would say that that was an experience. A lot of people came out to very negative experiences, so negative responses. I feel very lucky that I got at least a 50% positive response of my friend saying that there was a kind of baseline of unconditional love that would never shake our friendship, no matter what happened. I was also thinking about my first Pride parade, which did not happen in Houston, but I was in Boston, and I was 21 years old, and I was doing an internship, and that was the first time that I had not lived in the American South, and Boston was much more liberal and progressive. And a friend invited me to go with his friends to the Pride Parade. And that was a life-changing moment. It was a realization of, oh my God, there are tens of thousands of people who are LGBTQ, and they aren't ashamed about it, and they don't hide in closets. And it's not what I was seeing a lot of in college, which is guys would deny that they were gay, but then get drunk and fool around with other guys, but then never speak to them again because they were in the closet and scared or didn't want to acknowledge their sexuality. And I just remember the feeling of liberation and affirmation of being able to walk down the streets of Boston. And honestly, there was a safety to that because I was not anywhere near where I lived or where anyone would know me. But there was a sense of self-acceptance and a validation, and that I had finally found my tribe. And I came to Houston in 1990, and Houston Pride has its own special, unique vibe, which is absolutely wonderful. And that has been very special to me. But that first Pride march in Boston really impacted me.
If you're joining us, we're speaking with Andrew Edmondson and Melissa Vivanco, the male and female identifying Grand Marshal nominees for the 2022 Pride Parade. Now, Melissa, is Pride still relevant?
Oh, Pride couldn't be more relative now than ever. I cannot, like, if we look at what has happened just here in Houston, you know, when I walked in my first Pride Parade in 2001, we were on the streets of Westheimer. And I remember parking in the neighborhoods, having the, all of our committees would park in the neighborhoods. And it was such an incredible event when we had it on Westheimer. And the year we moved it to downtown Houston, I wasn't sure whether or not this was the right move for our city. But when I walked into City Hall and saw where the Pride Festival was and saw how all of us just, it was just so different, the Pride Festival. You could sense an energy of, we've made it, right? We now are moving out of our neighborhood and going to downtown Houston, where there's 800,000 people that come out you know, walking in the Pride Parade for the first year when we were in downtown Houston, I remember the sensation and the feeling of big city, major event. This is no longer just an event that's going to be solely held in the gay neighborhood. We've now made it to downtown Houston. And I think as we look around in different cities and we acknowledge the amount of pride that is shared in June, there is not a single time in June that is not filled with rainbow colors in our community. And I can see where my, you know, straight friends get so excited to show their pride and show, you know, the community. I have so many friends that will, you know, in the month of June will fly their flag at their home. And I think that not only is pride relevant, but pride is where it all started. You know, it started in New York. It started as a riot. And we have to always remember our history and why we have Pride Parade and remember, you know, the individuals that were hurt and that lost their lives fighting for their right to be authentic and their true selves. And we have to remember the transgender community. And that right now is where the fight is for us in our community. We have to be able to work together to pass legislations on three levels. It's got to be the federal, it's got to be the state, and it's got to be the local. And we have to utilize our pride and the Pride Parade to remind everybody that in Houston, the fourth largest city, we still do not have a non-discrimination ordinance. And we should be pushing our legislators, we should be pushing our mayor to pass HERO 2.0.
Andrew, is Pride still irrelevant?
I think it's incredibly relevant. What we're seeing now is our Texas Governor Greg Abbott and our Attorney General have put a huge target on the backs of transgender families. They have declared that gender-affirming health care, which can save trans kids' lives, is child abuse. And they have opened investigations into parents of transgender children. I believe 9 families were under investigation for committing child abuse because they were seeking medically appropriate care from licensed professionals to help their children develop. That is absolutely shocking to me that that would happen. And I think that we in the Pride Parade need to take a huge stand with our trans community and say, we will not accept laws that Texas has tried to pass that prohibit transgender teenagers from participating in student athletics that everyone should be able to participate in. We will not accept conservative Texans, Republicans, passing bathroom bills that diminish the humanity of trans Texans by telling them that they are not able to use the restroom that corresponds with their gender identity. This is very much still a battle, and we live in a little liberal blue oasis in Houston, but the larger Texas is beet red, and we have so much work to do at our state legislature to protect the rights of trans children and trans families.
Melissa, what is your greatest Pride memory?
Oh, wow, there's so many. I think my biggest Pride memory is the year that Lou Weaver won Pride Grand Marshal. I worked side by side with Lou for, you know, the vast majority of my time with the Human Rights Campaign. And for those of you that you don't know, Lou is my cousin. And
really?
I remember walking into the HRC steering committee when they were going to vote me on, and Lou walked in, and I looked at him and he looked at me, and then someone, I don't remember who, introduced us, and we laughed and we said, well, we kind of know each other. You know, my aunt is married to his grandfather. So we had no idea we were getting voted on the steering committee the same day. And from that moment on, we made a decision that we were going to do what we could to work together. And we both felt you know, very strongly that the political realm and being political co-chairs would be amazing. And Lou and I, you know, we were both on the Board of Governors during the same time. We were the political co-chairs at the time. And having Lou, you know, win Pride Grand Marshal and, you know, walking with him and seeing his excitement, I think for me, was the most memorable Pride experience that I've had, because I knew all of the work that Lou had done in the community. And, you know, he is very, very well known in the community. The way we had, the way we worked our steering committee as political co-chairs is Lou was a subject matter expert with transgender rights. And I can't tell you how much I learned working side by side with him. I knew Lou before he transitioned. So just understanding having, you know, a family member transition and going through, you know, pronouns and changing pronouns, it was something that I can tell you is I learned so much through that experience. And watching Lou, you know, go down the streets in the Houston Pride Parade in downtown Houston, I think for me was probably the most memorable experience, because it mattered. It mattered for me, and it mattered for the transgender community.
Andrew, same question to you. What is your greatest Pride memory?
My greatest Pride memory was in 2003. The day before Pride, a momentous Supreme Court decision came down called Lawrence versus Texas. And that Supreme Court decision originated in Texas, right here in Houston. And for decades, sodomy laws had been used to criminalize the existence of lesbian and gay people. And what happened in Texas is the police walked in on two consenting gay male adults who were having sex. And they took that case all the way to the Supreme Court. And it was a major milestone that sodomy laws were ruled invalid and that the Supreme Court had affirmed our basic civil rights as LGBTQ people. And let's be honest, Texas is a tough environment to be gay in. And to have that decision come out of Texas and know that Houston had helped push forward civil rights, not just for Texas LGBTQ people, but for all American LGBTQ people, there was this sense of jubilation and a sense of pride. People like Mitchell Kateen, the attorney who first took that case and started that long legal journey that led to the Supreme Court. And I remember there was a sense of jubilation at that march because Houston had moved the country forward. And there was just such a sense of shared happiness and pride that this had happened.
Melissa, what should our listeners know about you that they may not already know?
I really am not sure that people really understood in the time that I was volunteering, which I was volunteering an enormous amount of time between 2014 and 2016. I don't think many people really realize that I had a full-time job at UPS. So when I, in 2016, there was an incident where Brad Pritchett, Lou Weaver, and I were trying to find a field office that we could open up for the 2016 election. And at that same time, my girlfriend at the time was very heavily involved with the HRC, Hillary Clinton, sorry, HRC, super volunteers. So Mary Lucky had reached out to me and said, I have about 100 phone bankers and we just lost our location of where we phone bank. So it was a combination of Lou Weaver, Brad Pritchett, and myself. I flew to DC and lobbied to get funding. And I was able to get that funding by going directly to DC and speaking with the, at the time, I think it was Karen Quimbley. I spoke to her and I said, we just had a HRC gala here in Houston where we were able to raise an enormous amount of money. And I think that it's going to be super important for us to earmark some of that money to give us some type of field office where we can bring volunteers in. I have 100 volunteers that are ready to phone bank. If we can get funding, I can make the commitment that I will be there to run it. And with that commitment, we were able to do our first HRC field office in downtown Houston, where we had during the election, we had two levels where people were volunteering. The first level was where people were volunteering with the swing states, trying to push to get Hillary Clinton elected. And the second level was where we were solely phone banking for Harris County. And although we lost the 2016 presidential election, not by popular vote, but we did lose that election. If we look in 2016, we turned Harris County solid blue. And I would hope that people understand the work that went behind the scenes to get that done. You know, I would leave my home in the morning, go to the HRC office, work my UPS job, and then at 5 o'clock, we'd have phone bankers come in. So my days during that time were very long, but it was well worth it when we had the outcome we did in Harris County.
Andrew, same question to you. What do our listeners need to know about you that they may not already know?
The 1990s were a long time ago, but I do feel like I was incredibly active and a leader in the community starting in the 1990s. I served on the board of a grassroots AIDS service organization called Body Positive that helped people who had recently tested positive get connected with other people who were HIV positive, learn more about their diagnosis, learn more about healthcare and emotional support options. I was also on the board of directors of an event called Halloween Magic. And in the early 1990s, when there was very little funding coming from the federal government for AIDS, Halloween Magic raised $1.5 million over a series of years to help basically keep alive grassroots Houston AIDS service organizations that were serving those living in the community. I was the chair of the first World AIDS Day, Day Without Art Committee in Houston. In 1994, there was a realization in the Houston Arts Committee that people in Houston weren't aware of the impact that AIDS had had on Houston, and that we in the arts needed to be leaders and step forward. And on World AIDS Day, December 1st, we organized a massive press conference and events all across the city to draw attention to the fact that the Houston arts community had been devastated by AIDS, that this was a crisis impacting Houston, and that we needed for the community to become engaged. And I really feel like that campaign, which went on for a series of years, every year on December 1st, really helped change hearts and minds and raise awareness of the extent to which HIV had devastated Houston. Today, I continue with my AIDS activism. I'm on the board of a group called the Oral History Project, and we are chronicling the stories of Houston's response to the AIDS crisis over the last 40 years. And we are compiling that information and storing it at Rice University's Woodson Research Center. So that will be a tremendous resource for historians going into the future. I've also been fortunate in that I was the first chair and chaired for 2 years the Houston Gay and Lesbian Film Festival in 1990 and 2000. And from the first year of the festival to the second year of the festival, we increased fundraising by 2,500%, and we also increased attendance by 50%, and that was under my leadership. So I'm aware that that was a long time ago, and people may not be aware of that, but I'm proud of being able to be part of those organizations who helped create significant change for LGBTQ people here in Houston.
We're speaking with Andrew Edmondson and Melissa Vivanco about the Grand Marshal nomination process, which is open until April 15th. Voting is at pridehouston.org. Go there to vote. Thank you, Andrew and Melissa. And this is Queer Voices.
Our website
is Martha, what'd that feller on the wireless just say? Something about them interwebs?
You don't have to ask Martha. We've got all the names, dates, and webpage links for people, events, and anything else mentioned in the show right on our own website. It's queervoices.org. We even link to past shows and other tidbits of information, so check it out. queervoices.org. Besides, Martha is a cat. She doesn't know anything about websites.
This is Brian Levinka, and today we're speaking with male-identifying Grand Marshal nominee Travis Torrance. Welcome, Travis, to Queer Voices.
Hey, Brian. Thanks for having me. It is great to not only talk to you, but it's also great to be back on the radio airwaves. I don't know if you knew this about me, but before I went to law school, I was an on-air personality for a top 40 radio station in New Orleans. Quite different from what you do.
I did not know that, but you do have the radio voice.
I used to introduce Britney Spears songs for a living, and my dad used to say that I've got a face for radio, not a voice for radio.
Oh. So my first question is, who is Travis Torrance?
Travis Torrance is a proud gay man who lives with his partner, Heath LaPrey, in Oak Forest with our golden doodle Grits, who is a bankruptcy attorney for Shell. But the thing that really fuels my fire is giving back to the community, Brian. So I like to say that I'm a philanthropist, a community organizer, an attorney, and an advocate for different groups who've been marginalized. And the reason why it's so important to me is because I'll never forget, Brian, the first day of college, and I went to Tulane for undergrad in New Orleans, where I grew up. The first day of college, my parents sat me down in our living room and they said, Travis, we are making major sacrifices. And at the time, my dad was working around the clock and my mom was working two jobs. They said, we're making major sacrifices to send you to college so that you can make a better life for yourself. And I kind of turned to them and casually said, well, you know, look, of course, I'm going to do my part and make good grades and get a decent job, and the rest will be history. And my mom, who died my junior year of college, she stopped me and she said, Travis, you make a living by what you get, your compensation, your salary, your benefits, but you make a life by what you give. Mm-hmm. And I've been so fortunate, so blessed with a myriad of different opportunities that I feel like it's my duty, it's my obligation to help and to work with people and communities who've been marginalized. So that is who Travis Torrance is.
Can you tell us how you came out?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. I think that I'm still coming out, right? I think that, you know, people, straight people especially, like to think that you come out only once and then you're out. But every single day I'm coming out to new people and new communities. But the very first person that I felt incumbent to tell was my dad. And so I called him from the tunnels in downtown Houston and said, Dad, I've got something really important to tell you. And it's that I'm gay. And he held the phone for a very long time, so long that I thought that he had hung up on me. And later I found out he was crying. And the first words out of his mouth were that he was going to continue to love me and support me as the person he raised me to be. And so I've been really thankful to have a dad who's interested in listening, learning, and growing. But I also had to come out in the workplace as well. And Brian, I spent several years as an attorney managing pronouns so that people would not know that I was gay. I spent several years not talking about how I spent my time away from the office so that people wouldn't know my sexual orientation. I spent countless hours hiding it from my friends as well. And I'm sharing more than I otherwise would, but it was taxing for a variety of reasons. And for me, it led to a very dangerous relationship with alcohol, such that if I had not come out when I did, I'm not sure I'd be able to sit down with you and have this conversation today. I would not be here. So coming out, being able to be my true and authentic self in every single context of my life, it saved my life. And it's another reason why I give back and try to encourage inclusivity, diversity, and equity in all communities so that people will feel comfortable coming out.
Can you tell us about the work you've done in the Houston LGBTQ community?
I like to divide up the work that I've done in the LGBT community in three different layers. First, there's the work that I do on a national level that, of course, affects people who live right here in our community in Houston. And then I think of the work that I do on a statewide level that, again, helps people in our community. And then I like to think of the work that I do with and for the people who live right here with organizations who live in Houston. And if you allow me to start with sort of the national level, I'm the national president-elect of the National LGBTQ Plus Bar Foundation. And for those of you who are not familiar with that organization, it is the membership organization for LGBT attorneys in the United States. And so we, on the one hand, advocate for inclusivity in the legal profession, whether you are working in private practice, nonprofit, a for-profit company, or government. And we provide a sense of community, because if you imagine, you know, I started my career after my federal judicial clerkship at Norton Rose Fulbright, which previously went to market as Fulbright and Jaworski. And at one point, I was the only openly gay associate in the Houston office that had over 450 attorneys. But in addition to that, the work that I'm super excited about that we've kicked off over the past 2 years is that we've been working with the Biden administration, the Senate Judiciary Committee, and senators from around the country to support the nomination and or the confirmation of more LGBT federal judges. Because as we know, representation in our federal courts, that matters as our rights are constantly under attack across the country. We've also done a lot of work with the what's called the LGBTQ plus panic defense. And if you're unfamiliar with that, it is when sexual orientation is used by a defendant in a criminal matter as the excuse for their violence or their behavior, including the murder of LGBTQ plus people. And the reason why that's so important to me is that there's a study that has said that 1 in 5 LGBT people will experience a hate crime in their lives, and their sexual orientation or gender identity should not be an excuse for criminal behavior. So we organize people to testify, and we work with legislators and legislatures to propose legislation to ban it. And we've done it in California, we've done it in Illinois, Rhode Island, Nevada, Connecticut, 12 other states, but now we're also, Brian, we're working with the House Federal Judiciary Committee on a law that would apply across the nation. We do work with the access to being on juries on the state and national level to ensure that people can't be struck from juries based on their sexual orientation or gender identity. We do work with the blood band as well. So as you probably know, men who are sexually active with other men in the last 12 months can't give blood. So even if you're in a monogamous relationship, you can't give blood, whereas a man who's had sex with dozens of women could. So we're working with the FDA, Red Cross, other organizations on that. Move into, though, the state level. I'm currently the vice chair of the LGBT law section of the State Bar of Texas. And there, the important work that we're doing is teaching lawyers across the state about the impact of laws on our community, from the immigration laws to landlord-tenant issues. Think about the family code and family law, probate, and so much more. And in addition to educating people about how the laws affect our community, we're also teaching lawyers how to provide affirming legal services to people who are a part of our community. I know I'm being long-winded, so cut me off, but I do want to focus on the local organizations. And I couldn't be more excited about being secretary of the board of directors of the Holly Field Foundation. And for those of you who are unfamiliar with the Holly Field Foundation, Jay Holly Field was a Houston entrepreneur and philanthropist who died of AIDS-related illnesses in I think it was 1994, but he left a foundation in his name meant to prevent discrimination of the LGBTQ plus community, to educate the community, and also to secure equal rights for LGBTQ plus people. And we have given millions of dollars to organizations across the city. One of the first gifts that was received by the Montrose Center for the Law Harrington Senior Living Center was from the Hollyfield Foundation. The LGBT History Research Collection at the University of Houston meant to preserve our history and the history of our movement, and people who've been active in the movement in Houston, also funded by the Hollyfield Foundation. We've supported groups like AIDS Foundation Houston, the Bayou City Performing Arts, Pride Houston, PFLAG, and the list goes on and on. So that's a taste of sort of what I do in the LGBT community here in Houston, Brian.
If you're joining us, we're speaking with Travis Torrance, a finalist for the Male Identifying Grand Marshal of the 2022 Pride Parade. Now, Travis, do you think that Pride is still relevant in these days, this time?
Absolutely. It's definitely relevant. One of the things that I like to do for and with organizations is friend raising and fundraising. And I think that what Pride does for us more than anything is the friend raising aspect. It takes people being vulnerable and sharing their stories to change hearts and minds. And if you're not going to change hearts and minds, at least you are going to change people's behavior to make it appropriate in every single context. But our young people, our older people, people all over the country and all over the community need to see shining examples of what it means to be an LGBTQ plus person in our community. And Pride elevates our stories day in and day out, not just on June 25th, the day of the parade this year, not just the month of June, Pride Month, but throughout the year. So if the question is whether Pride is relevant, Pride is absolutely relevant because we've got a long way to go in this movement.
What is your greatest Pride memory?
My greatest Pride memory has got to be the first Pride that I spent with my partner. We've been together for 9 years. We met on St. Patrick's Day about 9 years ago, and Pride was a few months later. And being able to spend it with someone who I was truly proud of, and I knew that we were, even though we had only been together for a short amount of time, I knew that we were on the cusp of building a great life together. Just stopping and watching the floats go by and thinking, finally, after all of those years of hiding who I was and not bringing my true and authentic self to work or to family life or anywhere else, I finally had found my personal pride.
What should our listeners know about you that they may not already know?
That's a tough one. I think that I share a lot on social media and elsewhere, but I think that you should know that I'm a big patron of the arts, so I'm on the board of directors of the Alley Theater, and I love, love, love theater. Actually, my partner's not here right now because he's spending a weekend in New York doing two shows a day. So we are big, big theater freaks. When I am not practicing law and when I'm not advocating on behalf of different groups in the community, I love running and working out and enjoying Houston's restaurant scene. I'm also active with both of my school's alumni group. So I'm the chair elect of the Yale Law School Fun Board, and I'm on the Dean's Advisory Council for the Tulane School of Liberal Arts. But those are a few things that perhaps people don't recognize because they don't get to see it on my social media accounts or otherwise.
We're speaking with Travis Torrance, a finalist for the Male Identifying Grand Marshal for the 2022 Pride Parade. Now, Travis, do you know where people can vote for Pride Grand Marshal this year?
I do. You go to the Pride Houston website and then you click on the link on participating, and then it shows a link about Grand Marshals. And then for my category, you click on Male Identifying. It's going to take you a few clicks, but once you get to the Pride Houston website, you should be able to figure it out.
And I think we should note that you have to live within 100 miles of downtown Houston to vote.
That's absolutely right. And for those of you who live outside of the 100-mile radius of downtown Houston, you can still participate by donating. And all of the money goes to scholarships for LGBTQ plus students. So that's another way for people to get involved and also to support the candidates who are running for Grand Marshal.
Thank you, Travis. If you're joining us, we're speaking with Travis Torrance. He is a Grand Marshal nominee for this year's Pride Parade. Thank you, Travis, for coming on.
Thanks so much for having me. This has been super fun, and I am looking forward to June 25th.
This is Queer Voices.
Brendan Bourque Shield is a playwright, but he's also a lot more. He's a very busy man. His plays have been produced by Stages Repertory Theater, Death and Pretzels Theater Company, and the Landing Theater Company, where he serves as a playwright in residence and the literary associate. He also is no stranger to KPFT, having been on So What's Your Story, and he frequently contributes to the monthly live show Grown Up Storytime. He, for 6 years, worked as a teaching artist for the Alley Theater and a consultant in creative writing at the High School for Performing and Visual Arts. And he's the host and producer of the Landing Theater New Works podcast. His latest play, Sunrise Coven, just opening at Stages and will run through April 10th. Brendan, welcome to Queer Voices.
Thank you very much for having me, Deborah. It's really great to be here. I listened to the show and I started looking through the backlog and I realized there's probably more than a few people that you've interviewed that I know and adore and many more who I don't know but would like to know. So thank you for that.
Well, that's great. I'm glad to hear you're a listener. Sometimes I'm surprised to learn of people who listen. I'm like, we always think we have no listeners, but it's great that we do. One of the things that we are all about is showcasing the queer community. You have a very interesting story. I noticed in the kind of the themes of your play, they often touch on our lives and times, including sperm donors, conspiracy theories, and now with this new play, you're tackling the subject of healthcare or maybe the lack of healthcare in this country. But I also noticed that a lot of this, especially this play, it comes from a very personal place. So will you tell me a little bit about that?
And I do think it's a really interesting connection you just sort of drew. I had never really looked at the intersection between queer issues and the stuff I write. But of course, there are some intersections because I was raised by two moms. And one of those moms is very much at the center of what inspired this play. My non-biological but legal guardian mom, Karen Bourque, got sick a couple of years ago after a surgery that went badly, and she was put into emergency care and then the ICU, and she was in a pretty severely unstable medical condition, so she needed lots of rehab, lots of different kinds of specialists, just sort of a whole team of different kinds of doctors seeing her and tending to her case, and unfortunately, her insurance was not adequate to provide for all the needs that she had. And so she kind of lived in this medical purgatory for the last 10 months of her life, where she got bounced around from facility to facility. And as her insurance depleted, she got sort of kicked down the chain to progressively lower tier medical facilities, eventually ending up at this nursing home in Conroe, Texas, that was pretty underfunded and a little bit decrepit. And it had this real feel of being one of those out of sight, out of mind places that we all know exist, but try not to think about. And there was this emotional charge to the place that really fascinated me through a combination of a charge created by the patients who lived there and were treated there, many of whom had dementia. And so they were sort of in a different reality than the one I was living in. And also from the healthcare workers who worked there, which was a mix of people who were really miraculously resilient and seemed like unstoppable, and other people who were incredibly burned out by the day in, day out struggle of having more needs thrust upon them than they were equipped to deal with. And speaking for myself, after something like 10 months of taking care of my mom's insurance decisions and financial affairs and showing up at the hospital after work every day, I was beginning to identify with the burnouts. I was starting to feel resentful of my job as a caretaker. So I had an appreciation for sort of both types of healthcare worker that I encountered. And I wrote a play that explored them and also my own burnout and the question of how, if at all, it's possible to come back from that. I think at the same... Oh, sorry, go on.
No, you go ahead.
Well, I think at the same time, another thing that really influenced this play was that my mom was a witch for most of her life. She was a practicing pagan. And so part of her standard of care towards the end, part of the way I tried to help her standard of care towards the end was bringing some of the witchcraft that was sort of a staple of her spiritual orientation into her treatment in terms of observing pagan holidays and saying some pagan prayers. And so that's where the witchy element of the play came from. But it's out of that experience that this story grew.
Brendan, you're going to be amazed to hear this, but I actually was Facebook friends with Karen.
No way.
And it was one of those situations where, you know, we conversed every now and then over the years. And then suddenly I didn't hear anything and I didn't know she was sick. And then finally somebody posted something about her passing. So I really feel about this to hear this personal connection. Let's set up this place, Buckstock, Texas. Now, I guess Conroe was pretty much the model for it. But what's going on in Buckstock?
You might say not a lot is going on in Buckstop, or you might say quite a lot is going on under the radar in Buckstop. It's one of those towns that you drive through on the way to things. At least that's how most of us know this type of town. You can think of a town like Archer City or Palestine, some of these really small Texas towns. Imagine the main job centers from those towns were taken out of the mix, and then fast forward 10 years. And imagine the kind of decrepitude that would exist. And then imagine just a strain of absurdity and ridiculousness and fanaticism running through that. The kind of fanaticism that attracts cult-like organizations. It's also just kind of a heightened world. Like, I wouldn't say my play is gritty realism. I would say it's heightened, somewhat absurd, somewhat farcical. So I would say Buckstop is a somewhat satirical, but hopefully still respectful and humanity-loving look at towns like that as the backdrop for this play.
And the wonderful Susan Cousin plays the, I guess, the main character, Hallie, who is a nurse who's losing her vision and therefore loses her license. And yet she still wants to help the people that she cares about, that who are her patients. So tell me a little bit more about what transpires because of that.
First of all, shout out to Susan Cousin, because I don't think I really appreciated until I started to watch her rehearse what an exhausting and demanding role this is for the actor playing that part, because she is in every scene and there's something like 18,000 words of the play and like a third of them are hers. So I started to fear at a certain point, I'm going to make her every bit as burned out as her character if she does this 17 times. But no, she's amazingly resilient. And also, I'd like to note, in the theater, there is this tragic surplus of women in their 40s and up who are amazing actors who are basically at the top of their game after having been in it for like decades. And there are not a ton of roles for that age bracket. Once I realized, like, I was writing a play with that, I realized I was going to have a wealth of different options for casting. And Susan was just one of the best of the best of that group. And it was really an honor to even get the group of people I had auditioning for that part that I did. I'll say that Hallie is sort of a composite of all the different kinds of healthcare workers and all the different stages of burnout and resiliency that I saw from healthcare workers. And her determination is, I think, at the core of her character. Whatever she's doing, she is kind of unstoppably bent on doing it. So in the moments when she's being selfish, she can be a force of real destruction. And in the moments when she's being selfless, she can be a source of great magnanimity in the play. I sort of got lost in my love for Susan Cousin in answering your question. So you can steer me back to the question. That'd be great.
That's all right. There's also an aspect of this that deals with Big Pharma. Can you tell me a little bit about that character and what's going on there?
A lot of the play deals with how to get people who need access to overpriced, exorbitantly priced pharmaceuticals. That's sort of the plot mechanic of the play, is coming up with a clever workaround to the Big Pharma system. But it is rooted in some real stuff that real people do to have to get around the exorbitant prices of the Big Pharma system. I don't think it's unknown at this point that a lot of people get their pharmaceuticals from across the border, either in Canada or Mexico. So many people do it. It's so prevalent that we have a medical tourism lane set up at the border, specifically for people who, you know, hop down to Juarez to get their insulin. And you can buy the same drugs at a fraction of the price from English-speaking pharmacists with American dollars. Like, it's built into our system that our system is a failure, basically. And this play sort of uses that real bit of unfortunate social circumstance, but uses it in a funny, ridiculous way that probably couldn't happen in real life.
The play actually has been described as gallows humor. So it's very funny, but it also touches on these very tragic and dramatic aspects of life. And one of those being the example that you just gave. But there's a character in the play, and he's a veteran, and he's somehow getting illegal substances to help the people. Is that correct?
You've got that correct.
I didn't know if that was like too delicate or giving too much away.
I think that's right on the line of saying the gist without giving away the prize.
This play illustrates kind of the way it is, but you're saying it doesn't have to be this way. What insight do you have about that?
I want to be careful when I say that. It's true, it doesn't have to be this way. I don't want that to in any way imply that I think this is a simple to fix problem. American healthcare is a incomprehensibly Kafka-esque serpentine maze of different problems and institutions and interests. To suggest it doesn't have to be, and that if we all sort of kumbaya'd together, we could fix this in a hurry, is, you know, a little pie in the sky, a little Pollyanna. But I do think that it's worth reminding people anytime we can that just because you don't have to look directly at this injustice that is happening every day in hospitals and outside of hospitals and in nursing homes and in other forms of the healthcare system where people are being denied access to the level of care they need to live a life of dignity, just because you can't see those things doesn't mean those things. I believe the main character in this play is Hallie is keenly aware of that disconnect where because people don't have to see it, they don't have to think about it. I joked one time as the pandemic was starting, you know, if Sunrise Coven was real, Hallie would have seen exactly how this pandemic was going to play out, all the callousness of it and all the ways that the, you know, case numbers would have spiked. And she would have come up with some quasi-illegal plan to address it early on, because I think anyone who's worked in the healthcare system has seen this disconnect where despite the fact that we are all compassionate to the people who are in our proximity, sometimes we lose that compassion with distance. And what the healthcare system does is it creates all different kinds of distance between one human being and another, different ways that it can sort of cut off the human need to be conscientious and responsible and love your neighbor. There are so many different places where that has a chance to break down in the way our system is currently set up.
Exactly. And it is one of those things that people easily can turn a blind eye to until it happens to them. And then they have to face it the hard way. And I know people who are working with healthcare for all. And of course, I'm one of those people that thinks healthcare is a human right and should be available in this country, much as it is in other countries, so that everyone's taken care of. What else should people know about Sunrise Coven?
Well, I try to remind people, because when talking about it invites these conversations on how frustratingly entrenched the healthcare system is and things like that, I try to remind people it is a comedy. I don't think it has necessarily anything new to teach you, but I think it has some affirming reminders of things that people either want to hear or need to hear. And I think it's fun from moment to moment. I don't think it feels like medicine, pardon the pun, or at least it feels like a sugar-coated form of medicine. I don't want to scare people away with the idea that this is some sort of didactic screed on healthcare and indicting it, because I think moment to moment, it's a story of a wacky bunch of characters who love each other and love their community and are trying in different, confused and dysfunctional ways to help it.
I could see it as a television show, an ongoing series, actually. So this is Deborah Bell, and I've been talking with Brendan Bork-Shill, and he's the playwright of Sunrise Coven, which is playing through April the 10th at Stages Repertory Company. You can get tickets by checking the website, stageshouston.com. Thanks, Brendan, for being with us today on Queer Voices.
This has been Queer Voices, which is now a home-produced podcast and available from several podcasting sources. Check our webpage, queervoices.org, for more information. Queer Voices executive producer is Brian Lavinka. Andrew Edmondson and Deborah Moncrief Bell are frequent contributors. The News Wrap segment is part of another podcast called This Way Out, which is produced in Los Angeles.
Some of the material in this program has been edited to improve clarity and runtime. This program does not endorse any political views or animal species. Views, opinions, and endorsements are those of the participants and the organizations they represent. In case of death, please discontinue use and discard remaining products.
For Queer Voices, I'm Glenn Holt.